Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the London School of Economics, Institute of Global Affairs. My name is Marta Foresti. As some of you know, I work at the Overseas Development Institute down the road here in London, where I'm the director of the Human Mobility Initiative. But I'm also visiting fellow here at the LSE Institute of Global Affairs, along with my colleague Jibril. And so here we're also hosting, in collaboration with IOM UK office, this event. For those of you who don't know, the Institute of Global Affairs here at the LSE is worth finding out. It's a very interesting experiment, I think, that a number of universities are engaging with, which is to create a department that facilitate the translation of academic research and ideas and evidence into policy. And I think the LSE is particularly well positioned to do that, given the history it has got, certainly in this country and globally, to influence the world of action as well as policy. And so at the LSE IJ, we have been for some time, and Jibril and others have been working on the topic of global migration, which of course is, I would say, one of the defining global issues of our era. And so we are delighted to collaborate with, of course, the International Organization of Migration of the United Nations on this and other occasions. We are here today to not talk about remittances. Remittances are really quite a funny one. I mean, I started to work on migration only a few years ago, and it always comes up. I tweeted today, you know, I always hear the same sentence. They dwarf aid and FDA and FDA and foreign direct FDI, and foreign direct investment is probably the you know, in terms of volume, is the most significant opportunity we've got to maximize the benefits of global migration, both in countries of origin and host countries. And yet, we all get very frustrated that we know very little about the difference that this large volume of money actually makes, and we know we don't focus near enough about the role of the people that send this money and the people who move and make a difference around the world, and specifically diasporas, groups around the world, who are, of course, the ones who have the real potential to translate that money into real impact, whether it is in their host communities, in transit, or in countries of origin. So we're going to try to not talk about remittances, as in we're not going to talk too much, or in fact, probably given my panel, there's nobody from the World Bank here, so we're not going to talk too much about the overall volume, but we're going to talk a lot more about the use of the money and how it can be harnessed better. But more than anything, we're going to talk about diaspora and people who send the money. So with that in mind, let me introduce, first of all, Tawhid Pasha, who's a Senior Programme Coordinator of IOM here in the UK, to maybe help us set the scene and say a few words. And then I'll introduce the panel, who will take us into some of the details of the various aspects of what we know and what we could know better about the role of diasporas in migration development.
Thank you, Marta. Yeah, I'm here on behalf of IOM, my chief of mission, Dipti Pardeshi, who apologises that she couldn't make it. She's actually caught in long-distance travel held by monsoon rains in India, flying on her way in, so hoping she makes it to the UK safely. But first of all, thank you very much to our co-hosts at the LSE, and particularly to Jibril, who is a visiting professor here as well, and who we've got good links with. And it's a pleasure to be co-hosting this seminar. And thank you to Marta as well for coming in and moderating this session. And really looking forward to some great discussions. This evening's seminar is the second in a series of migration seminars that we're hoping to hold this year. And it's also a belatedly marking the International Day of Family Remittances, which has now been recognised in the UN calendar. So on that, it'll be nice to have, on the back of that, it'll be nice to have some discussions. The first event was around gender and migration, and looking at some of the impacts migration has on gender and vice versa. And not speaking about remittances, Marta, but yeah, again, we do know some of the important positives and negatives when remittances aren't managed properly through, say, for example, financial inclusion initiatives, or where there's heavy dependency that it has on families back home. And as Marta said, we shouldn't forget the people who are behind the remittances, the people who are often migrant workers in countries where their rights may not be fully respected. Often the remitters are diaspora, second or third generation descendants of parents who have come to settle in places like the UK. Diaspora can also include people who are here on a more temporary basis. They could be students, they could be experts who are working in various fields in the City of London or wherever around the UK. A lot of discussions have taken place on the particular target around remittances, which is set in the Sustainable Development Goals and in the Global Compact for Migration. And this year, just focusing on the Global Compact for Migration, which has been adopted by the UN General Assembly at the end of last year, this Global Compact, there's a lot of focus this year particularly on the actionable commitments and what needs to be set in motion, what processes need to be formulated to ensure that these commitments that states have signed up to can actually be actioned. And I think tonight's seminar could throw some light on this, because in the Global Compact, diaspora are recognized particularly, their contribution to development is specifically recognized in the Global Compact, which is a major, I think it's important to recognize that diaspora being formally in that, in an international framework, is quite significant, because up to now, their contributions have not really been formally recognized. So tonight, yeah, how can we optimize the many roles that diaspora can play in development and support them in ways that benefit both home and host countries? As we know, diaspora are contributing back to their countries of origin and the countries where they're living in. And they don't need our help necessarily in being told that they are contributing in beneficial ways. But we can maximize their contributions both as states that host diaspora communities and states that benefit from the remittances and the skills that diaspora transfer back. And it'll be useful to explore how some of these processes can be aligned with each other, how these sets of countries can start talking to each other, how international organizations such as IOM and others can play a role in creating some of these enabling frameworks to enable diaspora to ensure that their contributions are not lost or are much more meaningful, both back at home and in this country. And through IOM, we've been recognizing through our 3Es process, engage, enable, empower, that we need an enabling framework for diaspora to be respected, and we need an engaging framework for them to be able to properly have their resources recognized and maximized in the country of origin. So with all this being said, welcome to tonight's seminar. I hope we have some great discussions. It's a great pleasure to see many of you over here, and looking forward to talking to you later on in the evening.
Thank you. Thank you, Tawid. And thank you for setting the scene for us, reminding us of how much there is out there in terms of frameworks and networks and coalitions to take up the challenge and the opportunity to maximize the role of diasporas, including through financial remittances. And just let me be clear, I wasn't for a minute suggesting that obviously remittances don't matter. It was just a comment on the fact that so often we stop at the consideration that they are large and potentially larger. So let me introduce the panel, and also let me also bring to you the welcome from my friend Piroshka Nadjis, the Deputy Director of the LSEIJ, who couldn't be here tonight, but of course is very happy to co-host this event with IOM. So first of all, we've got Dipali Fernandez, who's a senior migration and economic development specialist at IOM at the headquarters in Geneva. So Dipali's work focuses very much on we were just discussing, having a coffee, on financing and the economic aspects of, if you want, the link between migration and development. And as such, she's working across IOM and with other agencies to try to create some of those alliances and institutional frameworks and collaboration to achieve the vision that Tawhid just proposed to us. And she worked before IOM, she worked at WTO and UNDP and SADC, so she has a wealth of experience, you know, sort of in the economic development world as much as migration. We'll then move to Jibril Fall, who's been already introduced, is visiting professor here at in practice here at the IGA, and has played a role internationally in a number of occasions, including at the summit in 2016 on refugees and migrants that then led to the establishment of the Global Compact. But importantly, Jibril is the founding director of ADEPT, the Africa Euro Diaspora Development Platform, and a co-founder of GK Partners. And I think both platforms have engaged directly on working with diaspora groups and with countries across Europe and Africa on a number of very concrete initiatives. We then have Heather Cover-Kuss, who's the Economic Officer of the Commonwealth Secretariat, who specializes in economic development in small states. So again, specifically looking at economic development issues in the context of the Commonwealth, which I think is a really important strategic actor internationally on sort of creating opportunities and partnership between countries on the ground and across some of the countries that within the migration journeys are at both ends, are in the middle of the sending, transit, and host. And then we'll finish with Alex Murphy, who's the Vice President for Mobile Money at World Remit, which is one of the world's most important influential organization, company that actually does makes the transfer happen and works with the commercial operators, the technology operators, to make the transfers possible and to reduce the costs, which is one of the main target we were reminded we have in global frameworks, and I think has worked for a number of years in the technology transfer world, so we'll bring that particular expertise and what it all means in practice to try to maximize those benefits. So, Dipali, can you help us take up some of the issues that Tawhid helpfully sketched out by telling us a little bit more about what IOM will be doing in this space in terms of institutional leadership and creating some of these collaborations that matter so much to maximize the role of diaspora?
Thanks, Martha. So I'm going to try and stay away from the remittances, but otherwise Martha's not going to be too happy. But first of all, let me just say that I'm filling in for Marina Manke, who's the head of the Labour Mobility Division at IOM. And she was unable to make it because of circumstances beyond her control. To begin with, I think Martha made an important point. Who are we talking about? And I think this is crucial because the whole discussion on diaspora and migrants, and therefore any framework that you create around it, has to keep in mind that we're dealing with people with different skill sets, different genders, different income levels, different knowledge base, different cultural backgrounds. So there's no one size fits all policy out here, and everything has to be worked on from an individual country level and based on the sending and receiving country individually. So that's the first thing. The second thing is it's important also to understand what, you know, in which areas these contributions are being made. And of course, productivity is one. There was a McKinsey study that showed that even though migrants are 3.4% of global population, they contribute 9.4% of global GDP. You have, of course, labor force contributions, diaspora, just the numbers. Tawhid mentioned 258 million, but second and third generation as well is something that we need to consider. No remittance numbers, but what's important to keep in mind is that 40% of remittances go to rural areas. And this is important because if we're talking about developing rural areas, then it's important to remember this link when we're talking about any investment funds, any remittances that we talk about in that context. And in terms of technology, of course, applications, patent applications made by migrants and diaspora is reasonably high. So if we were to cluster frameworks,
we'd have to look at what are the channels in which migrants contribute. And what I tried to do was basically put together the sending country and the receiving country, and then just sketch out individually what these areas are. So apart from remittances, you have trade, which is goods and services, where what we call nostalgia goods, which is migrants basically buying their own cultural products, their own food products from their home countries, or even setting up businesses where they live. To say, for instance, if you live in the UK, you set up a business to develop or send back money home. The second thing is entrepreneurship, and this is an area that IOM is working on very strongly. We've developed a policy guide on entrepreneurship, and what we'd like to do is take this policy guide, because one of the issues that migrants face is you may live in a country, but you may not have access to finance, you may not understand the legal framework, you may not understand certain skill sets or technological backgrounds. And if you're a skilled migrant, you don't have so much of a problem, but you still have an issue. Maybe it's language or whatever it is. But if you're an unskilled one, you have an even bigger, these gaps are even bigger. So one of the things that we are suggesting is not that necessarily that migrants or diaspora should be treated differently, but that they should be given this opportunity to close these gaps so that they can enhance their contributions to the societies they live in. And, so small things like, matching them up with chambers of commerce in the countries that they live in so that they can contribute back home. Investments, we talk about foreign direct investments, but they're also smaller investments that people make in smaller enterprises back home or in the countries that they live in. You may set up a corner shop, for instance, in the UK, or you may decide to set up a small business, buy farming equipment in your home country. Whatever it is, no matter how small it is, it's an investment. Skills and labor, we know about how diaspora contributes in terms of skills, in terms of the labor force, the countries that they live in. And another area which is still difficult to quantify, which is social remittances. And here we're talking about the knowledge that people send back home, the technology, the information, the philanthropic contributions, because a lot of diaspora make important charitable contributions to the countries they come from. And also in terms of crises, what we found was not remittances, but money transfers actually go up in times of crisis. They actually remain the most stable form of transfers back home during times of crisis. So these are important things to kind of remember. And as Martha mentioned and Tawheed also enforced, it's important in all these areas to remember the individual. And the frameworks that you set up in these areas have to focus on the individual. So it's difficult, for instance, in trade to say, let's have a global trade agreement, which includes migrants, because there'll be a lot of political pushback on that. But what a government can do is at a national level say, okay, we'd like to give the diaspora a chance, so we give them incentives in the trade policy to set up a business or basic initial finance to start with. So in each of these areas, there are a whole range of things that can be created at a national level primarily, to begin with, and it can be enforced at the regional level as well. So these are some areas. Tawheed mentioned IOM's policy of 3 E's, which is basically that you engage your diaspora. Who is it? Who is your diaspora? And how do you reach out to them? So at IOM, what we do is map diaspora in different countries, see what they want, because it's not a given that diaspora wants to go back and invest or contribute to the countries that they come from. But we need to see what the diaspora wants first before we move into other things. And as Tawheed mentioned, enable and empower, which means basically governments create policies at different levels to enable this. These are some of the areas that IOM is involved in diaspora. There's mapping, there's engagement, there's policy that we work with governments. We help governments reach out to diaspora in the countries they live with, and we work with diaspora associations as well. Remittances, some of the newer areas, we also pilot a lot of new areas and projects. So for instance, in Somalia, we've working on skills transfers in the healthcare sector in particular. In remittances, we're trying to look at postal networks and how they can reach out to rural areas and how we can use them as payout mechanism. Financial literacy and inclusion that Tawheed mentioned are extremely important areas, because that's what brings people into the mainstream. And in humanitarian situations, when there's a crisis, for instance, as in Mozambique or in Venezuela, how do we basically utilize diaspora wants to contribute because that's their home country or where they originate from, but what are the mechanisms we can help in that process, that contribution? Some of the lessons we've learned is that we've talked a lot on the policy angle. We have a lot of information. We have the international frameworks that are set up, the GCM that Tawheed mentioned, the SDGs, the financing for development. So all these are in place. But we have to move now to practice, so from policy to actually implementing very concrete things that work. Secondly, is there's a need for a very fact-based framework. So it's not that we create frameworks which are not grounded in what diaspora wants or what government can do or what private sector is willing to contribute, but we need to bring on board all these stakeholders to work together towards achieving these. And one of the things we're doing out here is setting up something called iDiaspora, which enables diaspora across the world to talk to each other, you know, to connect with each other, to talk to each other, to look for business opportunities. In remittances, we have several areas over there, including, you know, focusing on sectors and products of specific interest. I mentioned diaspora's willingness to engage. Partnerships are crucial within government as well, between ministries, because it's not just the labor ministry, but it's central banks and it's trade ministries. And finally, technology, and I'm looking forward to hearing from WorldRemit, but technology has a huge role to play in terms of collecting information and telling us where to go, but also in terms of enabling remittance transfer costs to be reduced and a whole range of other areas. So I stop there before Martha sends me off.
Thank you, Dipali. This was extremely useful, including because it gives a lot of sort of leads for the speakers to pick up later, including the fact that, you know, around the financial transfer, there is both the technology that enables it, but also all the potential applications, the potential format that transfer can take, and so these innovative ideas around, you know, postal networks and others. And it was interesting to hear about the humanitarian reference. Adodi and my colleagues in the humanitarian policy group work a lot on issues of innovative financing in the humanitarian space, and I do feel that there is a real scope at the moment to apply some of that innovation in this space too, and generally linking the conversation with development. With development financing. So then, Jibril, engaging diasporas and making sure that they, you know, that they agree, want, and whether there is a genuine partnership with different groups. And maybe also help us, because I worry sometimes that a bit like the terms migrants, diasporas is a bit of a all-for-purpose term. So help us understand a little bit more what diaspora groups are doing, who they are, and how it works in practice. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Martha, and welcome everyone to the IGA here. And thanks for the collaboration with IOM and Miriam Shetty at IOM and Tawheed. And maybe, hopefully, IGA and IOM will continue to work together on these seminars. All diaspora, all migrants are not necessarily diasporans. Because there are diasporans who are not migrants. They're second, third generation. So the pool of migration is bigger than sort of migrants. However, the important thing is, I suppose, in this business we are in development, is the migrants and the diaspora who are involved in the development of their countries of origin. Or maybe as simple as their families, because their families are in their countries of origin. So by definition, their development work has an impact in there. I'll just make a couple of observations that all of us who work in development, unfortunately, we're in the business of failure. That's what we are in. So in that business, it is in our interest to look out for winners and winnings. And the diaspora, in my sense, is a good place to look at for possible winners and winnings. Ronald Reagan, who was very funny but was acerbic in his insults, one describes economists as people who would observe something happening in practice and explain to you convincingly why it cannot happen in theory. Now, there's a little bit of that in this development and diaspora. You have the global institutions who've been involved and governments who've been involved in development for 60 years, 70 years, and they admit they failed big time. You take individual migrants and diaspora in 15 years, sometimes 10 years, sometimes 20 years, they've lifted their families from poverty. I'm saying we need to look at those people and see whether we can learn from what they're doing. And of course, remittances, and for today we're focusing on the financial remittances particularly, remittances plays an important part in that. So, but they also cannot afford to work in isolation because they need, as Tawhid said, collaboration for policy. Now we're having a nice problem whereby my friend Matt is telling us not to mention remittances. It's a nice problem we have. 15, 20 years ago, we couldn't get policymakers to recognize the role of remittances. I remember meeting a junior minister in the Foreign Office before DFID was created years ago to try to explain the concept of the role of diaspora and the importance of remittances. And at the time, her view was the diaspora, as far as development is concerned, should just find a way of supporting Oxfam. Nobody understood the significance of remittances. And where the collaborations come are organizations like AFFORD, which is a pioneer diaspora organization I've been involved in, partly due to their work and others, were able to create a momentum such that an institution like World Bank got onto the scene. And that is useful for us, because in 2006, the Global Economic Perspectives Report for World Bank was devoted on diaspora, on remittances, and then that transformed it, because people would listen to World Bank more than they would listen to AFFORD. And if I'm sitting at AFFORD, my only interest is to make sure that what World Bank says is very similar to what AFFORD wants them to say. That's influencing. And even if you take IOM, today and for the past 10 years or so, IOM, in my view, best represents the understanding of diaspora development. That wasn't the case. Before 2006, I wouldn't even speak with IOM, because I thought they didn't understand. But through diaspora networks engaging, you could get that influence. And then they bring all of the power and the influence and the resources they have. And that continues to be important in terms of the role of diaspora, be it on remittances or at bigger development issues. In Dipali's presentation, we've seen another illustration of, is it wise to look at the diaspora as a grouping who knows something about development? Productivity is effectively three times the size of the diaspora population. So if every institution or every group of people were that productive, you know, the world would have been transformed. So 3% having an impact on productivity of 9.4. The raw cash of remittances for many small countries, it represents from 15% to 30-something percent of GDP. My own country, the Gambia, it used to be 22%. It's now gone down because of some improvements in the country, but that's 22%. The numbers are huge and important, and in my view, still more work is needed there because it's underestimated. The informal remittances, we are told that can be double the formal remittances. But the methodology for counting informal is still not very neat. So I've just finished doing a piece of work for the African Union, and my estimate, the formal remittances for all of Africa is, the adjusted numbers for 2018 is 86 billion. For me, if you count the informal And if you also count something that's not counted, that is what I call remittances in kind, whereby I am sending goods and resources, sometimes for office work, but instead of sending the cash, I'm sending the equipment. And many diaspora do that, partly because it saves them, it helps them save money. I think my estimate is it's 200 billion for all of Africa, not 86 billion if you count it. So it's quite high. So, and those numbers matter in terms of then the policy discussions you have. The reason why the minister was telling me in the early 90s could go just support Oxfam is because she didn't appreciate the significance of the numbers. As soon as the World Bank tells them, and they believe the World Bank, then the debate sort of changes. Now, what are the uses of those remittances and their impact? Of course, we know that over 80% goes to what would be called poverty alleviation. It goes to food, it goes to education, it goes to health. These are the three big ones. But that by itself has a whole lot of other economic impact. For example, the multiplier effect, because you buy education or health resources, those who work there receive the money and they spend it on other things and the money circulates and it helps the economy. A lot of the studies that also shows that there are families who retain remittances and forward invest it. So it helps in forward investment. Of course, many small enterprises get their capital from diaspora sources. And another important economic principle is these remittances brings the principle of aggregation and pooling. Because individually, there may not be a lot, but it's when you put together. You have entire industries, huge financial industries that are based on that. And, of course, insurance is the one area where the power of pooling sort of an aggregation gives you a lot more results that you would otherwise have. The last point I want to make is about what next can we do beyond remittances. And in 2003, I wrote a paper on mitigating the negative effects and imperfections of remittances. And that led to a program we called RemitAid, whereby the idea is to get remittance match funding so as to create a legacy. And I'll just give you an example. In the UK here, we have gift aid. So if you give money to a registered charity that, for example, supports a family in a developing country, there's about 25% tax relief on that. If you do that directly as a member of the diaspora to that person in the developing country, you don't get the 25%. So RemitAid is an idea whereby you can get the 25%, not you personally, but a common pool. And that common pool can be invested so that despite changes in the coming years of migration trends, you have a legacy fund that can be used to also deal with some of the problems that migration causes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jibril. Always inspiring. A couple of ideas. First, keep your networks in the FCO, just because maybe tomorrow DFID might find itself an office over there. These are for those who are following UK politics. Politics, I think it'd be really interesting when we discuss later to actually have a bit of a conversation about the politics of some of this potential, because I was listening to Jibril and thinking, one, it is absolutely the case that in the development sector we have struggled with this idea of the failure of development and to some extent, you know, struggling a bit with this thing that actually works better, which is that people move away from development problem and by migrating resolve them. It's something that I think politically in this idea of migration and development, we still struggle a little bit to understand and get right. And then finally, of course, this message that migrants, you know, transfer so much money away from their host economies back to the countries of origin, obviously can also fuel negative reactions in places where the debate on migration is far from balanced or sober. But with that in mind, which I think will be interesting to come back to later, let me come to you, Heather, in the context of the Commonwealth. Help us understand a little bit, also a little bit, how countries come together and what they're learning and what they're actually doing and possibly either negotiating or even possibly collaborating to make the most of this potential that we just heard about.
Sure, thanks. Thanks, everyone, for having me here today. I did prepare, but I didn't prepare enough. Like, I have a slide presentation, but it's in my pocket. So now it would be too awkward to try to set it up now. So I'll just, like, try to I wrote down what I thought was on my slide, so bear with me, please. So I thought I would just start out by explaining what the Commonwealth is and the Commonwealth Secretariat, because I know I take it for granted because I work in it every day, but I know that it's not something that comes to everyone else's mind all the time. So the Commonwealth is, we like to call ourselves a family of 53 sovereign and independent states. And we represent 2.4 billion people. Our population combined is 2.4 billion, and 60% of those people are under the age of 30. So it's a very young, vibrant population. We cover 5 regions in the world, and we have a lot of small states, so states with populations of 1.5 million or less. So 31 of our 53 states are very small states, and with that comes their own sort of unique challenges and issues. And I bring that up because we consider ourselves to be advocates for small states, and the team that I work in focuses on economic policy in small states. So in the Commonwealth Secretariat, what we do is we're the international body that sort of represents this family of countries, and we work on a whole range of issues from promoting democracy to encouraging the rule of law to promoting fair trade between these countries. We work on issues of climate change, oceans, natural resources, and then, of course, sustainable development, the sustainable economic development. And within the economic policy unit where I work, a lot of our work has focused on, you know, looking at small states and their vulnerabilities and how do we get that recognized, what do we do to push their development forward. And when sort of trying to lobby to the World Bank and the IMF to get them recognized as a special category that maybe needs access to funding wasn't really working out as well as we wanted to, we started to try to think outside of the box and think, okay, how else can these countries access financing? And we thought, well, there's diaspora out there. So we started to do some work around looking into diaspora finance and particularly diaspora investment. So not remittances exactly, but how do we get the diaspora to invest in their home countries? And so what we did was we created a survey, and we covered 6 countries in the Commonwealth. There's 1 in the Pacific, 1 in the Caribbean, 3 in Africa, and then 1 in Asia. And we got about 1,000 respondents in total. And we tried to, what we wanted to figure out was what was the investment potential? What is there? What do diaspora have available to invest? What do they want to invest? And what motivates them to invest? What stops them from investing? So we asked a whole range of these questions. And one of the key findings that came out is that there's a lot of untapped potential out there. There's a huge gap between what people are currently doing and what they're investing, and what they've expressed is what they want to be doing. So that gap between what they want to do and what they're actually doing, we consider that the potential that's out there for them to be harnessed. And we found out a range of different things, including the types of areas that they would want to invest in. So a lot of it is in real estate in their home countries. And I think it's the view of people eventually want to go back home. They want somewhere to go back to. They have their things set up. They can move in, live easy. But then they also expressed an interest in investing in education, in health, and in agriculture. There were some more things on my slide that I can't remember. But you know, we asked a range of questions. We also asked about, you know, what stops you from investing. And there was a lot of issues around mistrust of governments, a lot of issues around this lack of knowledge. They're not sure exactly where to invest, how they would start to do this. So there's some information asymmetry that's there. So when I think about using this information that we learned from our survey to then translate this to a broader question of how can can governments and diaspora collaborate to transfer knowledge more broadly? I think there are a lot of linkages that can be made because we have a better understanding of the diaspora and what they want. And you know, so I think, you know, we've learned that networks are important and that it's something that should be encouraged. We tried to get, and we got in touch with, like, the business owners of Bangladesh or something like that. There are networks here in the diaspora that, you know, that can be tapped into, that we can learn from. And I think, you know, it would be great if they could connect with their with similar organizations in their home countries, and governments can facilitate that sort of transfer of knowledge in that way. And then also using technology to bring to bridge these gaps is an area that, you know, can be explored. Reducing obstacles. There was a lot of people felt that red tape and bureaucracy was one of the issues that stopped them from investing further. And that's something that can be looked at and addressed. And like I said, this lack of information. So I think, you know, in terms of wanting to share knowledge to people, to diaspora communities, know exactly how best to use this knowledge and information that they have, how best can they translate that and transfer that to their home countries. And personally, I also think there's an issue with empowering the diaspora to maintain this connection. I think from the survey, we learned that there's naturally a connection there, that, you know, no matter how long they've been away, they still feel this connection to their home countries. But I think, you know, it would be a shame for governments to take that for granted and just assume that it will always be there. And, you know, I think there needs to be efforts made to maintain that relationship both ways and to sort of encourage it and keep people connected. And that might look in like a different shape for different countries. For some countries, that might mean allowing dual citizenship. This is not something that all countries allow. And that has an impact in people's sort of connection and their willingness to invest and their willingness to participate in their home countries, you know, in their home countries' activities and feel that they are still a part of what's going on there. It might look like, you know, a diaspora just event engaging the community, some sort of something that keep people connected and keep people in touch with their own countries. And I think that's all I had on my slide. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you. And it is plenty. And thank you for putting two very important things on the agenda. First of all, knowledge. The figure, the eye-watering figure of $200 billion potentially for Africa alone that Jibril mentioned earlier. What do we know about how far that potential investment can go? You mentioned, Jibril, earlier, the fact that it goes to, you know, largely to immediate poverty alleviation, but potentially education. Or, you know, we know a lot about real estate. But there is a lot more to find out and to encourage. And the only, you know, the only way is to ask those who make those investments. And so it goes back to the people and to diaspora group. And I genuinely think this is an agenda for us sort of researchers and sort of policy researchers to really dig a little bit more into, to acquire that knowledge. And the other one is networks and connections, and the fact that there is a potential there, the channel of transmission, that knowledge, that attachment, that money can travel further if that existing connection is nurtured and maximized. The other big channel that's has come up throughout the discussion is, of course, technology, which is how the money is actually transferred, and that makes some of this, you know, the further investment travel further, literally, physically, beyond the point of reception, I guess, of the money itself. So, Alex, tell us a little bit more about where we are at with the technology and what's going to happen.
Sure. So I'm just going to come in and show you just a few slides. I'm not going to go into very much detail because I think it's fun to really just provide a framework for thinking about this. Many of these questions have been raised today. The exciting thing about being last on the panel is that you get to frame your presentation towards or based on what your colleagues have said. And I think I want to take a step back even first before I delve into some of the discussion topics and bring us back to, I know we're not talking about remittances, but I want to talk about them just to give us a framework for thinking about how to engage the diaspora better. And that is, let's think about remittances in terms of what it truly is, from A to B, end to end, a sender and a recipient. There are always two people, two individuals, two communities, sometimes engaged as one, sometimes not. And then from that, think about the institutional structures, the infrastructure, the regulation that happens on for the sender and the recipient. Speaking from the perspective of a money transfer business, we have to think in this way. We have to think about what are we doing to engage and make the service better for our sending customers, and what are we doing to make the service better for those who are recipients of the money, because they're not always the same people, and they're not always, well, in an ideal world, they are. The intention is the same, but it's not always. And a lot of the investment from the money transfer industry to date has been in consideration of improving both of those things, but also specifically providing greater agency to the recipient in the choice of how they receive their money and how they spend it. So I talked about the things that, you know, things that we think about in those two frameworks are regulation, infrastructure, access to the service, which is where technology comes in quite a bit, and then engagement to with the people specifically. So if we think about then from a technology lens, what are we talking about? It's really four areas that our business is focused on, and each of those four areas is impacting the customer, both sender and recipient, in very specific ways. So low cost, this industry, all of you, we've talked, I won't say to death, about reducing the cost of remittances, but we can indeed go into deeper discussion on that. But I think the key point to remember is, yes, technology really helps to drive down the costs. Mm-hmm. If we think about some of the ways in which, pull apart a little bit about what those costs are, right? Again, infrastructure, physical operations of having shops and agent networks, if you bring that online, that reduces a lot of the cost incurred in providing a remittance to the customer. But on the receive side, this is where the exciting work that our business has really taken forward and seen a lot of impact is in engaging with our partner institutions. So how does a customer receive money on the other end? We work in partnerships with financial institutions like banks, cash pickup agencies, etc., but we also work a lot with mobile money. You might wonder, why is there a VP of mobile money at WorldRemit? It's because we've taken that to be a really specific service enhancement for the recipient so that customers can receive money onto their mobile phone instantly, wherever they are. So improving access in rural areas, improving service, or enabling a customer who perhaps was never going to be able to physically go to the agent location in the first place. We've heard anecdotal stories of customers who, one customer, his mother used to walk over 100 kilometres, not walk, sorry, travel over 100 kilometres to go and collect money because she had to go in person, show her ID, etc. She didn't have a bank account, but she's got her mobile phone and her mobile money account, and she can receive it day or night, any time of day, instantly into that mobile phone. It also then brings in some of the other elements we're touching upon here, the speed, the convenience, right? So we're no longer just talking about cost reduction, we're talking about life enhancement. If you can receive money, not anonymously, but nobody knows how much money you've got in your mobile account discreetly, right? You can do with it what you want, you can save some, you can... And again, rural locations. So 90% today of our transfers to places like Tanzania, Uganda, are received on mobile phones already. Extrapolating a bit from that, I know I said I wouldn't go into a lot of detail, but this one is an interesting fact. We did some research on the expected impact of digitizing all remittances for the education sector, and we calculated that over $800 million would be going towards education purposes. And we can see that because the technology we use enables us to engage our customers more deeply, understand from them, everything from like doing customer surveys to watching how they are, taking there's sort of a checkbox on what the purpose of your transaction is. You can statistically aggregate this information, and people can you can understand where the money is going. So investing back home is an example, education, paying for goods and services, etc. Bringing all of this back to engagement, if we think about again this decoupling of the sender, the diaspora member, and their recipient, and the different institutions and frameworks that are serving those two individuals, we, WorldRemit, we are engaging customers, for example, in, as I mentioned, through our technology, surveys, aggregating information based on customer behavior, but also diaspora events, community events, going and speaking in person to customers. And we're doing so in partnership with our partner institutions in the recipient countries. So this has a combined effect, not only of putting a face to the name, people and understanding our customers better, but also building trust and enhancing trust in the technology that they're using. And finally, likewise, on the recipient side, our partner institutions, we can work with them in the areas where we wouldn't be able to reach alone, such as in Rwanda, we're working with one of our telco partners that has a program for refugees in a refugee camp, and enabling refugees to receive money directly onto their mobile phones from abroad. So again, it's this two-pronged approach through the two institutions working across different geographies to engage both the sender and the recipient. So then finally, where does this take us? Feedback loop with policymakers, with regulators. A lot of this is a learning process. So for WorldRemit and other businesses like ours, it is really about, to a large degree, educating our regulators and educating policy members about, cost aside, infrastructure, how does it all work, but also how can we better engage the people we are trying to serve. So really looking forward to further discussion on this.
Thank you, Alex. And in fact, thank you to all my panel. I think it's been a fascinating and very concrete and engaging set of presentations. So I really look forward to the discussion, which I'm pleased to announce happens with about just 1 minute delayed on the schedule. Before I hand over to you, let me just remind you two things we just heard, two numbers. The $200 billion that in Africa alone would be mobilized if we were to include all forms of informal and not just financial remittances, but also in kind, and the potential of using that that investment, and the $800 million that, if all remittances were digitalized, will go as investment into the education sector. So again, think about. I said, let's not talk about remittances, so that we could talk about remittances. But now we have. Let's talk about how far the remittances can travel and reflect on what we heard about the role of those who send and those who receive for that. And on that, let me throw in the first question before I hand it over to you, which is largely for Alex, is every time we talk about migration, I always get frustrated that we always talk about something that happens at origin and something happens in destination. I'm really interested in what happens in between. So I'm just wondering whether with technologies and remittances, we can do something about what happens for people who are moving and in transit or spending times in different parts along that journey that may also facilitate that, you know, make that journey possibly less dangerous, possibly more productive, and so on. It's just a curiosity I've got. But if we have a roving mic and somebody can help, maybe sending round, or if not, just stand up and say who you are and ask a question, please, or make a contribution. There's one here.
Thank you very much for organizing this event. It's a very, very useful event. Thank you for that. I think I would support the view of Gabriel. It's actually, in my opinion, it's more than 200 billion. If you talk about the multiply effect, as you said, multiply effect in the way that you set up an investment in a country and people are employed. People are employed, they support their family from the employment. You steal money from the diaspora, and also people can also organize some petty trading around. So if you add all that, it's far more than 200 billion. But what I'm making here is that for us to realize the full impact of that, there are some problems the diasporans face. I don't know how you're going to discuss that or what kind of idea or support you can give. There has been lack of trust. For example, if you send some money to families down there, friends, for a particular purpose, in most cases it's not used for that purpose. So that has actually demoralized many people here, that the point of actually stopping remittances, because what's the point of sending money for a purpose and it's not used? Mm-hmm. So that is what happened. There are two ways about two kind of sending money. One is for your family or friends for their own use. That's one. The other one is use, and then the other one is for investment. And obviously, use both of them, and you don't get any. So that actually is demoralizing. So that could be a way how it discussed, it was mitigating that. So that is a very important thing I want to say.
Thank you. Thank you very much. For the next sort of mention, maybe who you are, and yes, it'll be important to come back to this question about what are the obstacles and this problem of trust, and whether, for example, technology alone can do something to facilitate that further investment. I've got two there at the bottom, one on the left and one in the middle here. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Ben. I'm from the Royal Commonwealth Society. Hello, Heather.
Hi.
Basically, so one of the things I'm trying to do is we've got a big network of associate fellows. And within that associate fellows, they're made up of really sort of amazing individuals from across the Commonwealth. Many of them Queensland leaders, and I don't know if you know of them, but check them out. They're really good people. And across that, what they've been nominated for this because of their amazing work that they've done in country. So a case study I've just done recently is, she wouldn't mind me saying, is Elizabeth, and she's set up a mental aid charity to sort of remove the stigma around mental aid, mental issues in Uganda. Now, touching on sort of like remittances a little bit, but also sort of the educational factor, is that we're in a position as a civil society to sort of be that link between, I suppose, diaspora in the UK, for example. I would want to sort of link with diaspora in Uganda and say, hi, look, you've got an amazing person here. And touching on the survey you said, which I'm very curious to see and to have a look at that, could civil society be a intermediary between not top-down government, but a grassroots kind of, you know, we're just here to bridge the gap between Elizabeth, for example, doing good, honest work and sort of demonstrating that development can happen honestly and clearly, and saying we could be a navigation route for sort of channeling your investment money that you want to put back into the community that isn't just financial. The other thing is also touching on like educational remittances. So people that have, as Gabriel said, the kind of the people that have made it, they've come and now they're successful diaspora, and maybe they've a doctor, a graduate in, you know, a PhD student in mental health, for example. This is a very specific case study, but an example. Could the educational remittances be sort of, could civil society or other organisations be sort of channels to take these people and say, look, people in Uganda, for example, we can sort of transfer their knowledge, not just financially, but knowledge as well? That's kind of my question. Is there a place for civil society within this, in that world?
Thank you, and thank you also for some of the very practical ideas about what can be done. So, please.
Thank you. No, that was a very, very interesting discussion. My name is Bashar Ahmed, and I'm from Shebeka. And I just wanted to kind of raise, which is the point, is talking about diaspora role in development. And I think it's important to recognize diasporas also operate in development and humanitarian spaces. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about migration and crisis, diaspora does to kind of step up and do kind of provide that. So even after a crisis has, you know, subsided, they will continue supporting the situation in the country. So I wanted to kind of maybe bring that to the discussion. How can we also look at not just as development actors, but also humanitarian responders, so connect these two dots. Thank you.
Great, thank you. There's one at the back and then one on the right. Thank you.
My name is Diesel, and have worked for Afford, and my interest lies around diaspora remittances, entrepreneurship, and humanitarian work. Jibril mentioned about the innovative remit aid scheme, which, if implemented, will have a potential transformative impact in terms of remittances. And I just wanted to ask a question around what you think needs to be done to get such innovative schemes off the ground.
Thank you. Let me add a follow-up to that. And do you envisage official ODA being part of what you can use to top up? And if so, how we can make it fly politically?
Yeah.
There was a question here on the... Yeah, is you, sir. Yes.
Yeah, my name is Jean-Léon Guamakabobi. I'm a lecturer, but I'm the coordinator of African Diaspora Bank. I was interested in the amount she said about the education, because I'm a lecturer. How could we involve on that if it's a project of 100 million to build up a good education in Africa? And I would like also to see ways in which we can work with IOM to build up an African bank here in this country, because the political environment helps us to do it. And then, instead of to depend on Western money, we can depend on ourselves to invest in Africa, because Africa is the future, and we have a lot of land. Instead of to wait for the food which coming to Europeans and Asiatic food, we can do it ourselves. That's why I invite all African people to be part of that bank, and it's possible to set up that bank here in this country. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Let me come back to the panel, and then we'll go back for another round. And can I suggest, Awida, maybe you also join us in this particular, as there is a question specific to what the AOM can do in the UK. But let's begin with the first broad questions about the obstacles that are still in place that prevent that further investment beyond immediate, if you want, poverty alleviation to take place. Who would like to go first to take that question?
You're looking at me, so I'll go. No, I think that's a really important issue. Lack of trust came up strongly in our survey, that it wasn't necessarily that they didn't trust the recipient per se. Let me explain a little bit. So we had this online survey that people answered questions, and then people were given the opportunity to then also. If they wanted to follow up, they could join a focus group. And then we had these discussions with focus groups, and there were focus groups of just, professionals. But we also had particular focus groups with business owners. And so I observed the focus group for the business owner, so I have a little bit more insight from that angle. So maybe there were issues of not trusting the people, but that didn't come up in the discussion group that I joined. So the lack of trust was more of just the environment in the country that sort of came up. Maybe there was political instability. They weren't sure that their investment would make a return. So it was that sort of issue of lack of trust, a lot of red tape, a bit of corruption, that kind of thing. But I'm sure, you know, the lack of trust of the person that you're sending the money to might be an issue as well. We know that there were issues around exchange rates, and people were getting around that by exchanging money with their friends that they knew were traveling. So it wasn't done through a bank or any sort of financial service provider, but it was done just between a network of friends. So that was an issue that people were getting around, these sort of obstacles that they had. But curious to hear if anyone else had any other experiences with how you overcome this issue of lack of trust.
Yeah, maybe let's come back afterwards, maybe on civil society. But I'd be curious to know, Alex, on these issues, is how far can actually technology help, and particularly the digitalization to make that money travel further, and maybe what some of these findings around the potential, for example, in further investment education is based on in terms of how is it that technology can leverage the impact of the of remittances further.
Yeah, so I think this is a hugely important topic for the industry, because to date, and it, funnily enough, the remittances industry is a very old industry, right? Western Union has been around for 70, 80 odd years. And in those, I would say in the last 10 years, the industry has started to work very, very hard on helping remittances get to the right individual. And that's been driven by a couple of factors. So the first is policy driven, right? Getting those individuals, enabling those individuals to have the right kind of account, right? Bankerization initiatives in a lot of countries, identification, helping people get an ID so that they can get an account. It's been driven by regulation, so anti-money laundering regulation, anti-fraud and corruption, anti-terrorist regulation, forcing money transfer businesses to ensure that the right person is who they say they are, sending to the right person who they say they are. But the next step is, okay, we've now done really well on getting it to the right person, but how do we get it to the right purpose? And to some degree, that is, that's what I was talking about a bit earlier, is A, giving that recipient more agency in deciding and determining how they can spend the money. So part of that is technology driven, right? We're again using the example of mobile money, but you know, a bank account is also similar, in that once the money's in the account, you have a whole ecosystem kind of marketplace of directly connected services that they could use that money to do. So they could pay a bill, they could send money to pay for goods or services, they could send money to another person, whatever it might be. A lot of that is sort of in flight right now. It's being developed, and it has to do with, again, infrastructure, technology, partnerships across those businesses and institutions. So I think that's a positive trend, but we're not fully even there yet on allowing that recipient to do what they want with the money easily. Otherwise, it's just, you know, cash in hand, and then I'm going to walk down to wherever it is I need to go to spend that money. And that's where we still see, again, sort of, it might be siphoning off some, taking a cut, whomever, or the cost of travel, etc., etc. The final point is again on to some degree, what we're talking about, if we really want to get to the purpose, you know, enable the remittance to get directly to the purpose, we are to some degree then removing the recipient from the equation, right? We're allowing, and that's happening already today, because in a lot of cases, that's what the diaspora member wants to do. They want to pay a bill directly. They want to buy something, they want to invest in a home, they want to pay their mortgage, whatever it might be. And that is something that is now expanding across the industry. Again, that has to do with partnerships, it has to do with policy and regulation, because some of the recipient institutions on the ground, you know, I'm just giving an example, but like a television company, if you have to pay your television bill, or your utility company, isn't necessarily regulated in the same way as a as a financial services institution. So there's a bit of a learning curve. So that's a roundabout way of explaining why we're getting there, but we're not there yet.
Thank you. And maybe, Jibril, after when we talk about remit aid in a minute, I was wondering whether this is also something that can be built in as a design, as a, some kind of incentive for that additional element to be invested further. But before we get to remit aid, this, I don't want to lose this point about intermediaries, and I was wondering whether you might pick it up. There was a question about the role of civil society, but also the fact that rather than thinking just that to individuals at either end of the transaction, whether there are ways to involve broader communities and institutions in this process.
You mean in remittance sending, or
yes, and in this potential of intermediaries, particularly, mm-hmm. in not necessarily just states, in civil society organisation, mm. playing a role to maximise the potential of diaspora.
I mean, we work actually quite closely with diaspora associations and civil society NGOs in different settings. I mean, in the skill setting that you mentioned, I mean, they are normally people who are on the ground or willing to. I mean, AFFORD, for example, is a very good example. Because they have set up several programs which are either sector-specific or, you know, skill-specific. And at IOM, we have a range of programs. We have historically had a range of programs dating back to the 1970s on helping diaspora contribute back to the countries that they want to, because we realized that there was this desire and that there was a need as well. So we tried to match that in different sectors, health, engineering, construction, different sectors. So I think civil society has an extremely important role to play for that and for and diaspora associations as well. And, thank you.
Quickly, sure. How do you, for example, like the transfer of not just finances but education and information, how do you quantify that?
How do you quantify that? Yeah. That's a good question, because it's not that easy to quantify.
There you go.
Yeah.
A lesson for a student, for example,
sure.
2 hours spent talking over the phone about how to do this, so I can have a sheet and say, oh, look, this is what
I've done. Yeah, well, I mean, one way to do it is quantifying by time. Two is to actually put a value to the person who is, mentoring or giving that assistance. What would they value their time, if it's of a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer, what would they value that time as in a normal circumstance, and then putting an amount to that, basically. So those could be two possible. And the other thing is, online kind of mentoring is great. It's more difficult. Sometimes people just don't have the time to go down, or they can go down for short periods of time. But if you have a long-term kind of thing that can happen virtually, which is what we're trying to do with iDiaspora, and we're lucky because Jibril is on our board. So, we're on it. So.
1 minute. Jibril, remit aid. I think that doesn't work.
Yes, remit aid as an idea is been around since 2003 and then formally 2006. By that time, it did make significant progress, and I personally was confident that we would have it by 2008, because the then chancellor, who I happened to be working with, was totally sold up to it. So when he moved from number 11 to number 10, we thought that was happening. But then you remember that Mr. Brown's prime ministership was rather, how do we put it? His honeymoon was not very long, let's put it like that. And soon after, you had the global financial crisis, so it put that to rest. But amongst the ideas at that time was not only to get policymakers to change, but to get the diaspora to change their remitting habit, which is now what businesses and technology is facilitating. That is, I can send money to address your problem directly to the school rather than to my uncle, who may choose not to pay the school fees. So that is important. But you can see technology and business actually offer you the solutions. You asked the question on would ODA money be used. Way back in 2006, 2007, around that time, I wasn't opposed to it, because I was speaking at the time the Conservatives were in opposition, but they were very supportive to the idea because they said we'll use ODA money. And the fluidity of ODA definition was in such a way that I didn't have a problem with it. And as we are today, I still don't have a problem with it, in that much funding can come from that fund, especially in the UK now, where we have the 0.7 and people are thinking that we're sitting on a lot of cash. I just wanted to comment on another thing, that the remittances, there's the economics of remittances, but there's also the sociology of remittances. Amongst the things the diaspora are experts at is to tell you how much they distrust everybody. So I cannot find a diaspora who trusts anybody. The diaspora distrusts everybody. So that's why you have to put it in waiting. Waited, W-E-I-G-H-T. I wait them. When they say I distrust, there's lack of trust. The waiting I give is different from total distrust. Because despite all of that, they still send the money to their uncle who spends the money on alcohol. And they send it again and again and again, because there's a sociology going on. And the Africans would complain until they hear the Indians, who would tell them how more crooked their families are. And so you have to take it in that context. But these facilities we have now allow you to make an easy choice.
I want to also ask Hamid if he wants to come in on that very specific question about the African Bank. Now, lots of hands, so let me just check with Caroline and Jerry. Hold on. We are now at the end, but we did have 40 minutes of networking, so what can I suggest that we carry on until 7:30, and then we take the questions. We are not going to take all the answers. The answers are going to come over a cup, not of wine, strange of coffee at 7:30. But anyway, Tawid, do you want to first take this question about the African Bank, and then I'll take maybe four or five?
I'll be very quick. Yeah, let's catch up in the networking afterwards. I think our role as IOM UK is to really facilitate as a bridge between the member states that we work with and the incredible initiatives that are going on within the UK diaspora. So happy to join.
Okay, so there is Bilal, one here in the middle, and then one here, and then we need to stop, and you can take the drink off, Bilal, otherwise.
Thank you so much for this very interesting discussion. My name is Bilal, Bilal Malayev, and I am a postdoc here at the Institute of Global Affairs. My question is, so we talked a lot about remittances eventually, and I think we owe it to the title for doing that, but bearing in mind some of the reflecting basically on recent input by Paul Collier on how migrants sort of infect the values of their host communities, and also thinking back about social remittances to their countries of origin, and taking you up, Marta, on your point on politics, what is the role of the diaspora also in terms of democracy and social development, not only monetary development? That's one. And two, what are we thinking also about the development of the host communities? Again, talking about this infection of values, are they polluting? Are they really not following recycling rules? Are they ruining your democracies? What are the lessons that we've learned in that space? And that also takes us to what you were talking about, Jibril, in that basically trust and cooperation. And much of the research that I'm doing at the moment is on trust and cooperation. And the idea of private and public good is also very fluid. So what is the connection? Are they learning from their host countries, or are they infecting them?
Okay. Everybody else will have to be very brief, and it's such a shame we cannot have wine to take on some of this. Especially when Paul Collier comes up. Okay, one here.
He's got the mic.
He was first. Sorry, he's been waiting for some time. And then there's two ladies here in front. Sorry. My mistake.
Hello, I'm Munir Bello. I'm from the GSMA Mobile Money team, and I wanted to
talk on the lack of trust, and I wanted us to expand it a bit with the discourse about lack of trust in terms of whether it be the sender or the receiver. I mean, Mr. Gabriel talked about when the receiver do send, they know that there's an issue with the sender, but probably they send it again. But another issue that we haven't talked about is the lack of trust with the institutions themselves. I mean, the sender might trust World Remit, but at the other end, in terms, especially in terms of mobile money, that we've seen that there's so much issue with the institutions themselves and the receivers. One of the issues that they always come about is the safeguarding of funds. So are the funds even safe? We talk about money laundering and terrorist financing, whether these organizations are being used. We talk about transparency of the fees, how much are being charged, and what have you. So these are the kind of issues that we see. And in GSME, in the area of international remittances, what we did with these organizations is to kind of have a certification to kind of checkmate and check this organizations so as to make sure that their operations are at the best practices and they are able to have that consumer trust within them. And we've been seeing some kind of fruitful benefits from that, whereby there's a trust within the senders and also the receivers in that end.
Thank you. Here and then over there. Can you pass the mic at the front? These two ladies. Thank you. Sorry about that. They had been waiting for a bit longer. Thank you.
Thank you. My name's Ngozi Fakye. I'm a PhD researcher on migration, on remittances and remittance behaviour of diaspora in London. So my question is hopefully very simple. It really is about, have you considered, I suppose it's for Dipali and Gabriel, have you considered in the work you're doing about hometown associations and the effectiveness? I mean, there is research that there's a lot of noise about them, but they haven't been so effective. So in some of my research, I've discovered that it's the skilling and the equipping of those hometown associations. So they will be fundamentally structured to be able to help with investing as opposed to the individual. And I think in terms of development, that would be sort of a first go-to. It would address issues of trust. It would, there's certain things, I think it's a significant area to explore and develop. Have you guys been thinking about it?
Thank you. And the very last year.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Chibwe Henry. I'm from Comic Relief, and I'm one of the development professionals in the business of failure, as Jabir said. So sitting in this room for me and listening to the conversation is really concerning, because my first question is, from whose perspective are we framing this topic? So we're talking as professionals in this room, and the only time we mention the recipient is about giving them agency. Yeah. And it's like, when do diaspora just get to be diaspora? Because they send money because they send money home. So crisis happens. You know, I'm a Zambian diaspora, and I've been in conferences talking to, you know, Zambian government and other officials, and they're trying to sell investments to us like we are £5 million investors. We don't have that kind of money. And we actually, you can sell all investments you want to sell me, but I always build a house at home. You know, and I think that for me is where we are kind of stuck, because if we look at it from that angle, then we stop talking about how much do you want to invest. We start looking at it from, you know, the why perspective. Why do you want to invest? How do you want to invest? And that's why I would really like to read that survey, because I think the next step for me is, what are you doing with that survey? You know, what's it informing? Where is it going? Because from this conversation, we're still talking as professionals. Mm-hmm. And the diaspora are busy taking their families out of poverty. Mm-hmm. And we're still talking about how we can tap and harness them. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think for me, that is a big issue that we need to think about when we frame the conversations in development.
Thank you. And with that, I'm about to give some homework to my speakers ahead of the coffee and to say just the last two words. First, I think it's important to end with this reality check. And this is always the risk when we talk about remittances and volume and the big numbers that we're all tempted by, that 200 billion is still made up of a number, you know, a number of small transactions that, where people have priorities, and the ways to get to the broader investment may well be an issue of trust, may well be an issue of technology, but is also a matter of, you know, the nature of that particular relation that, and transaction that ought to be respected and well understood. But let me say that I leave this room actually feeling pretty uplifted, maybe like you, not as well as you are. Partly because if, like you, like me, you've been in a number of conversations about migration the last few years where, you know, it was pretty depressing, and Bilal and I were in one maybe last week where the comment was terribly interesting but a bit sobering, and reflecting on the experience of the Global Compact for Migration, for example. Well, this is clearly an area where I think, as Jibril said earlier, rightly, is a matter of, you know, picking winners and doing something. And work is going on, and there is a lot of potential. We are talking about money that actually exists. Does not need to be leveraged, or, you know, is money that is currently being transferred, where technology development is moving that money faster, cheaper, and with a lot of potential. And so, although much needs to be done, it is one of those, this conversation around migration, that really feels like there is work, you know, things can happen and will be better. So the homework for my speakers is that we've got to talk about politics, I think, over a cup of coffee or a cup of tea now, in a very British way of doing it. But there are, you know, all the political dilemmas there. There are a few very specific questions that are there for you to pick up about hometown associations and others. And it sounds like, and it seems that trust is the recurrent topic that is, you know, continues to come back. And I think I leave the room with a genuine question about whether, you know, a combination of global policies, technology, and good intentions can mitigate that mistrust or not. And if so, how can we make some progress there? Let me also finish by thanking my colleagues and friends here at the IGA that made these events possible, in particular Jerry Mirich and Carolina Stern, who's here. I can't see Jerry, but Carolina is here. So thank you very much for your help, and to IOM for the collaboration. Please have a cup of tea, and remember, politics, trust, and hometown associations, and let it drop. Thank you very much. Bye. Thank you.